Thank you very much, everybody. It's great to be here talking about one of my favorite topics. I don't get to speak about this very, very often. Whoops. So these pictures here on this slide, I think are kind of emblematic of really what's going on in the world today in terms of global change. The picture on the left is the Muir Glacier in Alaska in the 40s, and the picture on the right is exactly the same spot in August of 2004. So you can see, for example, that this hill right here is exactly the same as that hill right there. There was a glacier here at one point, and now there's not. There's in fact a new landform called the Muir Inlet, which didn't used to exist because there was a glacier sitting in it. But from our perspective today, I want you to more focus on kind of right here, for example, which used to be rock and dirt because it was cold after all. There was a glacier right here. But now if you look next to it, there's plants. And so if there's plants there, there's all the things associated with plants, insects and vertebrates and things. So biology is redistributing itself around the world with the current global change that's going on. And all we can do right now is kind of sit back and watch and say, well, isn't that interesting? We don't know where it's going or really what's happening. So if you look in the headlines, last night I did a Google search for global warming and insects. This is the kind of thing that you generally hear about with the terms to climate change and insects, that you know the insects are going to take over the world because everything is getting hotter. But as was just pointed out in the first talk, it's really not that simple. Most likely, the insects that we don't want to get more are going to get more, and everybody else is going to be hurting. But so, for example, there's these data sets from the British Isles that show that insects are under insect assemblages are under a lot of pressure. Whether or not this is due to climate change or not, it's hard to tell. But it probably is closely connected to that, and kind of the other biggies of habitat destruction and these kind of things. So the name of this talk was in some sense a misnomer. So it's not just climate change that's the problem. It's global change in general. I'm a global change biologist. And in global change biology, global warming or climate change is just one little aspect of the whole business. So land cover changes, biological invasions, altered biogeochemical cycling, all of these things are now part of global change biology in general. And in particular, you could just say that climate change is just one little subset of altered biogeochemical cycling. There's lots of things going on with changing the carbon cycle. The atmospheric composition is changing. That's changing the composition of plants, which is changing nutritional supplies of food. The chemistry of the oceans are changing. A number of different things are changing because of these changes in the carbon cycle, not just climate change. So I want to look at some of these other aspects for a minute, just because they're kind of less considered than temperature, and we'll come back to temperature in a little bit. But as CO2 in the atmosphere goes up, plants change the chemical composition of their bodies. And the reason for this is that plants have two mouths, really. You have one mouth. You have one mouth where you take in carbon and the same mouth you take in nitrogen, the kind of the two biggies that you need to survive. But plants have two mouths, one for carbon and one for nitrogen. So we're shoving more carbon down their carbon mouth, and we're not giving them necessarily more nitrogen in their nitrogen mouth. So what's happening, it's the equivalent of saying you going to McDonald's and getting a Big Mac, say, and you have a certain amount of carbon to nitrogen when you eat that thing. But if McDonald's were to take that same amount of meat and shove it inside of an entire loaf of bread, you'd have to be eating a lot more carbon to get that protein requirement. So you can see here as CO2 goes up, photosynthesis in plants pretty much universally goes up, which increases plant growth, but you're not necessarily getting more nitrogen, so it's changing the carbon to nitrogen ratio. So if for an insect that's interested in nitrogen, this is lowering the food quality of the plant. Carbohydrates are going up. Now if you're interested in carbohydrates, like say an adult insect that's interested in powering its flight muscles, that's a good thing, so that's raising the food nutritional value of the plant. The allelochemical compositions of the plants are changing up and down in complicated ways, which may be good or may be bad depending on which allelochemical is the is the one that's of interest to the particular one that's eating it. So the bottom line is lots of things are changing, and it's hard to tell. So how do you study these things? Well, you know, we have lots of the kind of the insect in the growth chamber kind of experiments. But now we have a new technology which allows us to look at entire insect assemblages all at once. And this new technology is called FACE. Free air carbon dioxide enrichment is what that acronym used to mean. And now it means free air concentration enrichment, because it dawned on them that they could do more than just carbon dioxide. They could kind of enrich in all number of gases. This is the soy face site at the University of Illinois. You can see that there's this ring of pipes kind of embedded in a soybean field. There's no dome, there's no walls or anything. And these pipes pump out, depending on the particular face site, either pure CO2 or CO2 enriched air. And the whole thing's under computer control to keep the amount of CO2 in the middle of that ring kind of constant. So we can enrich areas in elevated CO2. And what we did at this particular experiment is raise atmospheric CO2 in this site to what CO2 would be in the general atmosphere for about the year 2050. So not that far into the future, about 40 years only at this point. So what happens? We sampled insects in these things, as well as herbivory and a number of other aspects. This chart here is showing the effects of the insect community. So the light blue bars are the ambient control rings, the green bars are elevated CO2 rings, and the yellow bars are elevated ozone rings. So you can see, in terms of total number of insects, there's a greatly increased number of insects in the elevated CO2 rings. And if you go then and look at these insect assemblages and see what it is that's doing this, as it turns out, it's primarily, in this case, Japanese beetles. And so what we have in this particular experiment is an interaction between a global change, one global change factor of altered atmospheric composition, and another global change factor, which is invasive species. As you figure, Japanese beetles probably aren't native to Illinois, and they're not. So this fellow, Japanese beetle, in fact, decides that these things are really tasty. If you look and see what they're doing in there, they're certainly eating more. This is now an experiment of taking Japanese beetles and putting them into a container with tissue that was grown in either ambient or elevated CO2. And the Japanese beetles, sure enough, they can tell what they're eating. They're not just accidentally happening upon these areas in the field. When they have a choice, they go for the elevated CO2 grown foliage. And whether you measure on a dry weight or a wet weight basis, they eat more. And in fact, they do better when they eat the elevated CO2 foliage. This on your left is eggs laid per female. On the right is male longevity. And when you feed them the CO2, the elevated CO2 grown foliage, the females lay more eggs and the males live longer. So they're going there kind of on purpose. They're eating more and they're doing better. And so from the point of view of a Japanese beetle, this is what the soybean field looks like under elevated CO2, which is kind of Twinkies to the moon. Now, in this particular case, whether you're interested in kind of the plant perspective, which is that there's significantly more tissue being lost to pests, or you're interested in the insect perspective, which is the Japanese beetles are moving in, the question is this a universal conclusion that elevated CO2 raises the numbers of insects or increases herbivory in ecosystems? So we did the same sort of experiment in a forest instead of in a soybean field. So the technology is basically the same. It's just way, way more expensive when you do it in the forest. So it's the same thing with rings and pipes pumping out, so we're basically just irrigating with high CO2 air rather than irrigating with water. This is the Duke Face site near Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And so in this particular case, we got no increases in herbivory in elevated CO2 and no increases in overall numbers of insects. However, when we break it down into, in this particular site, insect orders, there actually are all kinds of changes going on. The blue bars are showing insect orders which were increased under elevated CO2. The blue bars are the significant ones. The ones on the right side are the ones that are increased under elevated CO2. The ones on the left side are the ones that are increased under ambient CO2. So under elevated CO2, there's more spiders and there's more bees and wasps. Under ambient CO2, there's more mites, butterflies, and beetles. Now, what does that mean? Again, I have no idea. So, I mean, I work on this for a decade, and this is kind of the best I can do. That it happens. And this is the problem with studying global change and insect conservation, is we're really at the stage right now of just trying to figure out even what's happening, let alone what it means. So one possibility of what this means, though, is that there's an increase in predators under elevated CO2, and maybe that's what's driving down the numbers of prey under elevated CO2. So, you know, that's speculation at this point, but at least it's food for thought. Now let's come back to temperature. Temperature certainly is an important aspect of global change. This is a picture just showing you for the northeastern United States, the temperatures are in fact increasing, and they're increasing kind of more than the global average. Kind of the further north you go, the hotter things are getting. So, you know, the kind of the, what color is that? The orangish and the reddish circles are 3 to 4 degree Celsius increases, or 4 to 5 degrees Celsius increases in wintertime temperatures in the northeastern United States. So there's no question that this is going to do something to insects. And we're already seeing this starting. These are data, and you can get these data from the Northeast Climate Impacts website. But this is for corn earworm. Corn earworm does not overwinter in the northeastern United States. It overwinters further south, and it kind of, and the moths fly in the springtime. And you can see in 1995, the moths were appearing sometime around August 1st. And in 2003, the moths were appearing sometime in June. And so again, is climate change the only cause for this? How can you tell? We don't have 20 Earths and 10 of them with people on them and 10 of them without people on them. But it's very suggestive that at least we're seeing changes in the time that the insects, these insects are flying northwards. Now, despite the fact that what the kind of the first slide I showed you of insects are going to take over the world because it's going to get hot and there's going to be what there was one about the invasion of ants and there's insects are going to explode. We have this very strange consequence in the Northeast that things are getting hotter and colder at exactly the same time. Now, what does that mean? So it's getting hotter in the northeastern United States. I showed you the slide that says it's 4 to 5 degrees hotter over much of New York and New England. And this is bringing about significantly decreased snow. So for example, the big brown dots are areas where there's 25 days less of snow cover in the wintertime. So a friend of mine, David Wolf at Cornell, did an experiment where he removed snow from areas in the middle of winter. On this graph across the top is date, and down the side is the depth of soil frost. The first line up there, I guess I'm supposed to point with this thing. This line here is just the normal with snow, and this line here is the depth of soil frost when you take the snow away. So and we're seeing this this is just soil, but we're seeing this in plants. There's significantly more cold injury in, for example, the wine industry, the grape growing industry in New York, even though it's hotter. And with the case of plants, the reason for this is the plants aren't cold hardening properly because fall is going so far into the winter, and then it gets cold all of a sudden. So even though it's warmer, the plants are getting more cold injury. And even though it's warmer, soil depths are freezing deeper, 35 centimeters as opposed to 5. So the insects that are actually marginally overwintering in the northeastern United States are probably going to be affected by this. Now again, there's no study at all on whether or not this is affecting insects or not. This is different. But again, this is to, you know, kind of throw some data out at you to start thinking about the fact that global change is complicated. It's not just things getting hotter. It's things getting hotter and colder simultaneously. So this is a projection of what winter in the Northeast might look like So the red line is the air is kind of the winter in the Northeast that we know now. The white areas are the areas which might have significant snowfall by 2070 to 2100, say, which is the Maine and the Adirondack Mountains in New York State. So much of the Northeast is projected not to really have much snow anymore. Which is going to increase these freezing depths, at least for the next several decades, if not on into the next century. So what can we expect? Well, I've already showed you that just elevated CO2 in the atmosphere changes feeding and performance, in our particular case, in Japanese beetles. It changes community composition in the forest. There's other studies that have shown that that elevated CO2 can change host plant preference in organisms, tree herbivore parasitoid interactions, so higher trophic level interactions, and there's altered genotypic and phenotypic frequencies also seen just from the CO2 part of the global change. As climate's changing, both temperature as well as snow and water, we are expecting changes in insect overwintering, phenology in terms of the time that the insects are coming out in the spring, and how this might be in phase or out of phase with plant flowering, migrations and distributions. So I just want to acknowledge lots of people were involved in the various bits of data that I showed in this talk, and that slide just remind me, don't go more. So with that, I'll take any questions.
We've got time to. I want to try to get us on to the schedule in the conference proceedings, just so that people coming in can, know that when they get here, we're on target. So if there are questions, let's take our time and do it, and then give Karen some extra time to do that.
In the soybean study, we looked at the effect of elevated CO2 on everything. So we just basically trapped everything we possibly could. The year that I show the data for, there was no effect on soybean aphid. But in subsequent years, there actually was an effect on soybean aphid. So it's year by year. It depends. This particular year that I showed the data for was kind of the year of the Japanese beetle. We were all geared up to really go after them again the next year, and there weren't as many. And then the year after that, there were basically none. So they'll be back again, and we'll be ready for them next time. But now there's things going on with the aphids.
Could you briefly touch on asynchrony and flowering with pollinators? Are you familiar with any of that global warming work?
Right. So the question is can I just touch on this idea of asynchrony and flowering? Basically, plants, when they're coming out of dormancy, are primarily keying on day length. And insects, when they're coming out of dormancy, even though there certainly is photoperiod involved with it, they're often keying in on temperature more strongly than the plants are. And so, because the climate's changing rapidly, temperature's changing rapidly, including day length is not changing rapidly, there's the potential, at least for any animal, not just insects, any animal that's keying in on temperature to basically come out of hibernation at the wrong time. And this is starting to be seen in both vertebrates as well as invertebrates. There's evidence that this is happening with insects, and there's evidence that this is happening with birds, and there's evidence that this is happening with mammals, that there's this mismatch between the animals arriving and their food source. So either they're getting there too early or they're getting there too late. So the question is, are there data available which would tell us how much of a buffer forests would be on atmospheric carbon dioxide? Are you talking about kind of the carbon storage capacity of forests? So this is both tricky and controversial in terms of the amount of carbon that can be taken up in forests. There's no question that, you know, trees store carbon. The problem is that if you want to use trees as a carbon reservoir, you have to make sure that wood stays wood kind of indefinitely. And so natural forests then they burn down or the trees die or whatever, and then you lose all of the carbon storage that you've lost. And the ecosystem studies of kind of old growth forests indicate that you lose one large tree and you've lost all of the carbon storage that you've done for years. At the same time, probably the best thing in terms of forests and carbon storage is this latest proposal. I think it comes from Papua New Guinea, which is that they should get the developing countries who have significant forest resources should get carbon credits for not cutting their forests down. And that's actually probably a very good idea. The problem is that when this was first proposed in the early days of the Kyoto negotiations, the United States essentially tried to pull a fast one. You know, we deforested the entire Northeast kind of before 1800, 1820, that kind of thing. Starting around 1840s, the Northeast started reforesting, and the United States negotiators attempted to get carbon credits for this reforestation that was going on anyway. And so because of that, basically, the rest of the world cried foul and took away the carbon credit for anything to do with forests, unless it was actual planting, which gives developing countries a real problem, because if they could not cut down a forest, that's a huge amount of carbon that's just going to stay there locked as trees. So planting trees may or may not help. It depends on whether or not you can keep them from kind of burning down or dying for the next century or two. The reforestation that we have going on right now in the United States doesn't really count, because we did that 100 years ago. So the best thing is don't cut down any new forests. Thank you.